Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the noon hour approaches, it's expected that President Trump will announce that the United States will formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This would represent a sharp change in the U.S.'s Mideast policy and raises important questions about the future of the peace process between Israelis and the Palestinians, as well as our partnerships in the wider region. Daniel Ben-Ayim is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he researches U.S. policy in the Middle East. He's also a visiting lecturer at New York University. Previously, he served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House and the State Department, working with former Vice President Joseph Biden and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Prior to his work in the Obama administration, he was a staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, working with then-Senator John Kerry. I spoke with Ben-Ayim, who was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, yesterday afternoon, just after the first reports on the impending Trump administration move were released. Daniel Ben-Ayim, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be in Tulsa.
As we speak on Tuesday afternoon, the New York Times and several other press outlets are reporting that on Wednesday, President Donald Trump will announce Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And how far he goes in that announcement is still yet to be determined until he makes that announcement. But what does this do? You're speaking on the Trump administration in the Middle East. What is this likely to do in the short term in the Middle East from the announcement of this as Jerusalem is Israel's capital?
Well, I would say hold on to your hats. This is an issue that people across the Arab world and beyond are incredibly passionate about, and they're very concerned to see that people of all religions, Muslims, Christians, and Jews as well, have access to this holy city. Now, it's a funny thing when it comes to this question of whether America should recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Jerusalem is where Israel has all its government buildings. So as a matter of fact, in some ways, the government is actually already there. And so it's this unusual kind of fig leaf that we call the capital Tel Aviv. And even beyond that, it's something that Democrats and Republicans have promised to do, have put into campaign platforms for time immemorial. But then they come to power and something happens, something different happens. They look around, they get an intelligence briefing, and the briefing says something like this: Mr. President, the Middle East is a tinderbox. All of your Arab partners that you're counting on to do all kinds of things with, they're going to look at this decision and they're going to walk away from you. Not because necessarily they don't like you and not because they care only about the Palestinians. Mostly they care about their own interests. They're going to look at you and say, if my people see me standing with this person who takes this decision, you know, to put the capital of, to recognize the capital of Israel in Jerusalem, that's going to stir up a hornet's nest in my own country. And so you look at a country like Jordan, where the king of Jordan, one of the best friends that America could ever have, one of the best friends that Israel could have in the Arab world, he views himself as the custodian of Jerusalem and the protector of Jerusalem for the Muslim world. Saudi Arabia looks at itself as the custodian of the holy mosques and wants to be the leader of the Muslim world, which has its own problems. But they look at something like this, and the truth is, under the table, they're working with Israel all the time. They're working on intel cooperation. They're working with America. They're trying to make all kinds of things happen in Gaza that would be tremendously helpful to Israel. But when they see something like this, suddenly they have to watch their own backs and their own societies. So basically, it's something that people promise over and over again, and then they don't deliver. But they don't deliver for a reason, and the reason is that people are concerned about unrest. Now, over time, America probably should do exactly what Trump is describing and move the capital, move the embassy to Jerusalem to reflect the fact that that's going to be the capital of Israel for some time to come. However, if we do it outside of a peace process, then you kill that peace process because the Palestinians say, this is one of the things we were going to talk about. We both should have our capital in different parts of Jerusalem, Israel in the west, us in the east. And when you say that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, as America, you're saying we're not going to be a fair broker to that process. We're making a decision about where it's going to end up before it even starts. So now you could make a decision that, look, I want to weather this unrest. I'm going to darn the torpedoes and come what may, we're going to do this. If we have to close up our embassies for a few weeks of rioting, we're going to do it. But you can't make that decision and make the decision that you're going to go for the ultimate deal of Middle East peace at the same time. It really is an either or. And the truth is, if you're going to try to make peace and do this at some point in the future, you don't need to talk about it now. Just do it when you're ready.
Now, apparently, Mahmoud Abbas, leader of the Palestinian Authority, has been informed. He's basically said the peace process, he doesn't see the peace process moving forward. European Union representatives of that have warned the Trump administration about making this move. What's likely to happen in the short term diplomatically, not only in the region, but in other places that care about the Middle East?
Well, they're right to give some pretty dramatic warnings about what could happen to try to stave off something that really will harm U.S. interests on a variety of different issues. But I think if it does happen, they'll do their best to calm the waters as well. They don't want to see this happen, but if it does, they'll try to find a way to weather it and keep working with us. You know, I just think that some of the things that we want to get done, they won't be inclined to do. This young Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia seems really inclined to work with both the United States and Israel. But when you take a step like this that makes his life harder, not easier, at a time when he's trying to fire on every cylinder at once in his own country and in the region, he probably looks at that and says, boy, maybe I'd better be a little more circumspect when it comes to what I can do to help. And that's a much bigger play in some way than this kind of stunt of taking this mostly symbolic step or announcing some half measure. So I think they're kind of looking at the small symbolic picture instead of the big strategic chessboard.
And you mentioned Congress has passed laws. In fact, there was a law, I guess it was passed in 1995, that said we're going to move our embassy to Jerusalem, but there have been presidential waivers every 6 months ever since.
Well, now that's the interesting thing, right?
Yeah.
And this gets back to that same kind of hold me back, let me Adam dynamic when it comes to a promise like this. Candidates go out on the campaign trail and they say, let's move this embassy, and then presidents somehow find a way to do it later. And then later becomes never. Congress says, we're going to pass a law. You've got to move this embassy. But guess what? If the president wants to wait, the president can wait. So, you know, that's how people have deferred this decision. And what they've tried to do is give American peace negotiators a little bit of leverage so that they can go to Israel, which is in a pretty commanding position in many ways, so that they can go to Israel and say, here's one more reason why you should take tough steps to make peace with the Palestinians, because then you'll finally get America to recognize that embassy in Jerusalem that you want so bad. But I'm not sure it's written anywhere in the art of the deal that you should give away all your leverage right at the beginning before you get your person you're negotiating with to do what you'd like them to do. I suspect that that is not cutting-edge negotiating practice.
Now, as we're speaking Tuesday afternoon, the extent of what the president's going to announce is still unclear. We don't know if he's going to announce Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, or a secondary phrase, which has diplomatic meaning far greater than I understand, the undivided capital of Israel, or in fact, going ahead and moving the embassy. In fact, the speculation this afternoon is he will go ahead and sign the waiver, but begin plans to move the embassy at some later date. What are the ramifications of declaring Jerusalem the undivided capital of Israel?
Yeah, well, remember what I told you about this sense that the Arabs and Palestinians are afraid that the Trump administration is going to resolve the issues that they're supposed to be coming together to negotiate together and agree on a resolution, that we're going to resolve them up front and there's going to be nothing left to talk about. When you say the undivided capital of Israel is Jerusalem, what you're saying is you thought that there was going to be something to talk about Jerusalem when we came time to talk peace, but really there's nothing to talk about. So that's off the table.
So that means East Jerusalem will never be a capital of any sort of Palestinian state.
You know, these people tend not to traffic in nevers. You know, there's all kinds of ways to fix things in the future. But what you're really saying is whatever you thought you were going to get if you made a tough decision to be part of peace talks, that's basically off the table. One of the principles of peacemaking has been to leave the final status issues to be negotiated by the parties, not to predetermine them beforehand as a third-party mediator or broker. But this runs squarely up against that. But I think what you see is that President Trump feels like he made this campaign promise, and it's hard to tell which promises politicians feel compelled to keep and which ones they don't. But for whatever reason, while he's let some others slide, he seems to want to find a way to show results on this one. So I think he's trying to figure out what he can get away with. What are the limits of what he can do without sacrificing his other priorities? And if he says the undivided capital of Israel is Jerusalem, that's probably the end of the peace process with the Palestinians. But if he finds some way to say, look, the check's in the mail, then maybe he can maneuver his way out of this situation and keep that hope of a peace deal alive.
Now, as we speak again today, Turkish President Erdogan has threatened to break off diplomatic relations. He said this is basically a red flag, a line in the sand, that if the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital, he's threatened to go even as far as breaking off diplomatic relations. Expect that to be echoed elsewhere in the Muslim world, or do you think that's rhetoric?
I have to say, I think when it comes to Turkey's relations with America, I think it's rhetoric. Turkey's relations with Israel, though, is something different. That's been, for a very long time, this kind of wobbly strategic partnership. For a long time, these two countries very quietly traded together. Their politicians were close. And Erdogan has kind of upset the apple cart on that. And a great deal of American attention and effort has gone into trying to fix that relationship and keep these two allies of the United States talking, keep them in a constructive place in their relations. So Erdogan's not going to cut ties with us. He needs us too much. We have our own issues with Turkey, and they have their issues with us. But this doesn't rise to that level. But when he says, I'm going to cut ties with Israel, he knows that that's the kind of thing that would hit America where it hurts. And so he may actually do that.
Now, you mentioned the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and, of course, the visit by President Trump to the Middle East and especially to Saudi Arabia was sort of hailed as, you know, a new relationship between the United States and the Saudi Arabia. He was very much feted by the Saudi government, and there seemed to be some understandings there between the two countries. Jared Kushner has gone there several times over the course of the first year of the presidency. What is this likely to do? You mentioned the Crown Prince has moved aggressively against other members of the royal family, arresting a number for corruption. And what's this likely to do in Saudi Arabia?
I think the Saudis, it's an interesting thing. They're not going to be happy about this. And this comes at a time for them of tremendous volatility domestically. They're really, this Crown Prince is trying to walk a narrow path forward here to having really thrown down to confront a lot of very rich and powerful people in his society and really assert his dominance as the future ruler of that country. And he's trying to appeal to the young people of Saudi Arabia and say, look, I'm letting women drive. I'm reforming the economy. All of these old, rich, corrupt elites, I'm taking some of their money for you and I'm fighting corruption. And so he's trying to appeal to young people. Those are some of the same people who are going to be the most alienated about this kind of a U.S. policy decision. So it's pretty tough. But when it comes to this larger picture of America and Saudi Arabia, you know, it's interesting. I was in the Obama administration, and for a variety of reasons, the U.S.-Saudi relationship hit some rough patches. The Obama administration did a bunch of things regarding, you know, signing a nuclear deal with Iran, trying to help support democratic transitions in Egypt, you know, and decisions in Syria, all of which left the relationship in a pretty rough spot. And what that meant was that whoever came next had a real opportunity to actually fix the relationship and rebuild trust and use that rebuilt relationship to do something good for the United States. So I don't think it was wrong for Trump to go to Saudi Arabia. I don't think it was wrong for him to try to build a good rapport with the people in this very important country. Now, it's a very frustrating country for America because it's played a great deal of, it's got a great deal of responsibility for some of the extremism that's taken place in the Sunni Arab world over the last, say, 25 years or so. But what's interesting, it's a country where the United States can exercise influence if we've got a good constructive relationship. And it's a country whose leaders seem to be trying to push it in a different direction. Now, they may fail. And if they fail, that implosion may be really quite dramatic. But I think it's a very reasonable thing to do to try to build ties with them. But the question is, when you build ties with your partners, when you do things that help your partners in the Middle East, what are you asking for in return? It's the same question with the embassy. It's great to do something that they want you to do, but are you asking them to act responsibly in return? When you look at a situation like Yemen, where we have the largest outbreak of cholera in the modern world, this is not a thing that's supposed to happen in 2017, and you're talking about pushing a million people or more with cholera. and famine. It's about to be the world's largest humanitarian emergency, and it's pushed by this same crown prince and by the same Saudi idea that they can bomb their neighbor into submission. It isn't working, and I think that's a place where I really wish that President Trump, when he had his hands around that orb in that famous iconic picture, I wish he had said, "Now look, guys, this is great. I'm really glad that we're back on track here. We got to talk about some of the things that you're doing to destabilize some of the other parts of the Middle East." But all the evidence that we have is that they left with their own kind of green light. They left with their own sense that they can do what they want. If they want to try to crush their neighbor in Yemen, or if they want to try to muscle under Qatar, their other neighbor where America has an air base, they got the impression that they had a green light. Now, that may be so attractive to Saudi Arabia that they don't care what Trump does with the embassy. They may try to just weather it and keep enjoying what I call a blank check, Trump's blank check to Saudi Arabia. But I think they're going to find it's pretty hard if their own population is pretty angry about it.
My guest today is Daniel Ben-Ayim. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's formerly a foreign policy and Middle East advisor for former Vice President Joe Biden. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations talking about the Trump Middle Eastern policy. This was before the thing about Jerusalem. I want to get to an article you wrote, I think it was over the summer, which reflected on that trip to the Middle East, in which you said, you know, he seems to be offending leaders all over the world, but who is he not offending? And he wasn't offending those leaders in the Middle East. And right after that trip, you saw crackdowns in Bahrain. You saw the crackdown in Egypt, where the president of Egypt elected, I guess he put
his signed a civil society law that had sat on his desk for 6 months.
Yeah.
He saw Trump, and then a week later, he signed it. And it basically criminalizes civil society in Egypt. So all the civic groups and activist groups and people trying to expose corruption and bring about reform and push for rights for women, push for rights for Christians in that country, those kinds of groups, all of them, he basically treated them as though they were enemies of the state. And the America that I know believes in that kind of effort. We certainly believe in it at home, and we believe in it overseas. Now, sometimes it's one of many interests, but we tend to speak up and try to convince our partners that they'll be stronger if they actually listen to the voices of their own citizens too.
Yeah. This also comes at a time when, you know, the State Department is under great scrutiny for this reorganization. You've seen a huge number of senior people at the State Department leave. Certain amount of turnover is probably happens in every turnover of presidential administration, but this has been pretty unprecedented, the number of people. And more importantly, senior posts. The Assistant Secretary for the Near East, which covers the Middle East. There's no permanent person there, even nominated, much less confirmed. You look at the Far East. There's no person yet named for that post. How is this playing into how the United States deals with diplomatic crises?
I have to say, I think this is really dangerous. It's very important that America have the strongest military in the world. We want a military second to none. We don't want anyone to even think about messing with us. And we invest about $700 billion a year to do just that. Now, the truth is that, especially in today's world, there are only so many problems that you can solve with guns and bombs. We don't want to run around occupying countries with our soldiers. If we can help it, there's some great young men and women that I've met all over the world, and we don't want to send them into war zones. It's just, we can do it better, and we can do it cheaper. And if you think about something like the Ebola epidemic or Russian disinformation campaigns that are designed to cripple democracies in Europe, or negotiating with China over climate change or the South China Sea or anything, or trying to build a relationship with a country like India, it doesn't matter. We could spend $3 trillion on our military, and it wouldn't be enough unless we had diplomats in these places who really are empowered to go out and forge friendships and relationships for the United States to solve all of these problems in this big, messy, complex world. I mean, nobody looks at the last 15 years in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East and says, not enough bombs. It's just not connected to reality. So we need a strong diplomatic corps. Now, the U.S. Foreign Service is full of unbelievably talented people. They spend their lives. They go nerd out and learn Farsi and Urdu and Tagalog and, you know, and they go to every corner of the world representing American interests, championing trade, you know, I learned today that Oklahoma does about $200 million of trade with the tiny country of Singapore. You know, you want diplomats there making sure that American companies and American customers get a fair shake. You know, you want open skies agreements to fly and trade with other countries. There are so many things that we do that affect the lives of Americans, and we there being the U.S. government and the State Department in particular, that affect the lives of everyday people across the country, whether it's keeping you safe from Ebola or trying to promote trade or values or prevent the next ISIS so that our men and women in uniform don't have to get there. So when you see someone like Tillerson, I actually was hopeful that he would kind of take his management chops from the energy sector where he worked and bring them in and find a way to take this irreplaceable public trust and institution that is our State Department, our diplomats, and help them succeed. But instead, it seems like what he did, what it seems like to me anyway, and to a lot of diplomats I talk to all the time, is he treated it more like a hostile corporate takeover where he said, okay, we've got this company, we're going to skinny it down by 30% and then sell it off for scrap. So, you know, he came in and before he even really started, he said, he didn't even ask what the mission, core missions of the department should be. He said, okay, 2,000 fewer people and 30% budget cut. And so to me, that was kind of backward. You really need to say, okay, what are we going to do in the world? And when you spend $700 billion on the military, when you put through a $1.4 trillion tax cut, you're telling me we can't afford $5 billion with a B, more dollars to help prevent that war in the first place, to help create a safer world? After this $1.4 trillion tax cut, I just don't believe anymore that we can't afford 0.01% of that for our diplomats.
Let me ask you, because presidents of both parties have bypassed the State Department. President Obama did it. Both President Bushes, you know, presidents of both parties have done this over the years where they basically shove the State Department aside and go out and do personal diplomacy or personal diplomacy from the White House. President Trump has said the same sort of thing. I make the decisions over our foreign policy. Why is this different?
You know, and you're right that at the end of the day, the president is the decider in chief. The president gets to set the course of the country when it comes to foreign affairs. They get to decide what are the priorities in all of the messy 60-40 decisions, 51-49 decisions around the world. There's one person at the end of the day who decides whether it's the bin Laden raid or this embassy move or anything else. And that job belongs with the president of the United States, elected by the American people to do just that. But, you know, and it's true that sometimes presidents have done that without all of the bureaucracy of the State Department, all the rank and file, the 20,000, you know, people, you know, in Washington, et cetera. But it's really, really different if the president is making the decision in isolation than it is if there's really no information and advice even being listened to by the Secretary of State from his own building. And if that building is totally marginal and if that building is left rudderless and left adrift, the truth is in the Obama administration, the State Department, whether it was Hillary Clinton or John Kerry or Bill Burns, a wonderful career diplomat who finished out as Deputy Secretary of State and one of the most decent men I've ever known, these guys traveled all around the world at the president's instruction, extending the president's reach. I mean, there's one president and there's 200 countries. You know, you need a whole team out there touching as many different places as you can to extend our influence and our leadership. It's appropriate for the president to say, okay, this I got this file. But then what about the other 199 countries? You need somebody out there tending the store. And right now, there really isn't. And the truth is that there are foreign service officers and career diplomats who are filling in an acting capacity in many of these jobs. I don't want to suggest that America's completely shut down for business with metal gratings in front of our embassies around the world. The problem is if they're not permanent, then people don't know whether they'll be gone tomorrow. When you have an acting official like that who hasn't been confirmed by the Senate, who hasn't been given the president's blessing to stay, foreign leaders don't know what it means when they're talking to them. Will they be there in a week or not? And now some of these positions are, in fact, flat out open in Washington. And they may say that there are too many of them, but I sure would like to have a top diplomatic official covering East Asia with North Korea on the loose. And I sure would like to have a U.S. ambassador in South Korea when North Korea now has a nuclear missile that can hit the United States. It doesn't seem wasteful to me to put diplomats in those spots to represent Trump and extend his reach. And they should be people that the president likes because the president is the decider. But there should be people there representing America.
One last question. I know you've been in Iraq recently. What did you find when you were there? The country still has violence that occurs pretty regularly? Are things on the upswing? Are things basically holding stable? What would you say?
Well, Iraq is a very complicated, divided society in some ways. But in the last 3 years, basically Iraq had to fight for its life. ISIS surged all the way across Iraq, pretty much to the gates of Baghdad and to the gates of Erbil, which is the city where America's longtime partners, the Kurds, are. And basically, it looked like Iraq maybe wasn't going to survive, was going to be cut in three. But the Kurds and the people in Baghdad did a tremendous job of uniting, coming together, fighting, rebuilding their army, and basically block by block, in some case, taking back these cities.
Like Mosul.
Like Mosul, like Ramadi and Tikrit, and all of these cities in Iraq. So it's an interesting country. It's a country that was weak enough to fall to ISIS, but then strong enough and resilient enough to go block by block and take back their society and basically put themselves on the front line in what I call the fight for human dignity against the most extremist, medieval, genocidal, extreme terror group that the world has really seen. So I was going basically to look at what's the next chapter of U.S. engagement. Now, we helped them basically defeat ISIS. ISIS now is a bunch of sleeper cells in the cities who may be able to drop a bomb but can't hold, you know, a whole city block. And then there's some remnants in the desert who the Iraqis are fighting off. But for Iraq, that's kind of the end of the beginning, because they now need to get together amongst themselves and work to resolve some of these longstanding divides in their society. And frankly, they need our help to do that. And that help isn't going to be in the form of America bombing and fighting another war, but it is going to require basically all the sides trust us more than they trust each other. So I think we've got to stay and help them find a path to live together peacefully.
Now, you mentioned how the Kurds and Iraq government work together. When I think of Iraq, I think of the Sunnis, I think of the Shiites and the Kurds, and none of them really get along very well. Has this effort to defeat ISIS led to maybe some renewed engagement between the three sides?
It really has. It's an interesting thing. Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq have been through a very rocky and difficult 30 years, you know, under Saddam and then under the civil war that happened after the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. But they basically, the Sunnis in Iraq are now realizing that they've got to be part of Iraq and they've got to step up and be part of the political equation if they want anything to change. They saw how bad things could get with ISIS, and some of them were tempted by that originally, but basically they wholesale rejected that vision. They're in to be part of Iraq, and they're trying to figure out how to rebuild their cities, many of which were literally flattened in the course of getting rid of them. So the Sunni-Shiite dynamic in Iraq is actually much better than it's been. And the dynamic between the Iraqi government and the Kurds was incredibly good, but hit a bump in the road when it came to this question of the Kurds trying to assert their right to declare independence through a referendum. And it's been a messy month or two there, and I saw how that worked when I was there, because basically we wanted to talk to them about the next phase of U.S. cooperation, and they wanted to talk about their fight over Kirkuk. So it's touch and go, and it's messy. But I think that the Kurds, too, are going to find their way into partnership with the rest of Iraq. And I guess I would say that Iraq has a way of making fools out of optimists, so I'm taking a risk when I say this, but I'm cautiously optimistic that they can find a peaceful way forward, and I'm pretty certain that it's worth America helping them try.
Daniel Ben-Aim is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's formerly a foreign policy and Middle Eastern advisor for former Vice President Joe Biden. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.